All right. Good morning, everybody. We're on to day three
Morning.
of the Silverview Appeals. It's June 4th, 2025, 9 o'clock a.m. I'm Phil Albrecht, hearing examiner for Kitsap County. I guess at this point, if I remember the scheduling correctly, we're going to have Mr. Wright testify at this point, unless there is something we needed to address before then. Okay, let's say it. Let's
Yeah.
jump right into that. Now, Mr. Walker, that's your witness. So
Yeah,
let's go.
that's the yes, Mr. Examiner, good morning. That's the plan. My colleague, Ms. Oda, will be handling the questioning of Mr. Wright.
Okay, perfect. All right. So, Ms. Schlater, go ahead and bring up Mr. Wright if you can.
Doing that now. Mr. Wright, can you hear us?
I can.
Wonderful.
Okay, Mr. Wright, just waiting for your video to kick in.
Yeah, sorry. I don't mean to interrupt, but Dr. Cook is having a hard time with the Zoom link. It's apparently not working for her right now, and I would like her to be available during Mr. Wright's testimony. So I can go ahead and resend her her panelist link if that would be helpful. So I'll do that right now.
That would, thank you.
Yeah, let's give her a couple minutes, then we'll wait until she gets on. Ms. Clemson, are you getting any messages from Dr. Cook? It looks like she still hasn't.
Yeah, I she says the link isn't working for her.
This is
That's the
the
link that's available on the county website. So
Ms. Slater, did you send her something different the second time?
I just found out she should be able to just she's not going to have a panelist link. She should just be able to join from the web link that's posted on our hearing examiner page, but I'm just double checking that to make sure it's working. But I know other people joined from it, so I'm not too sure.
So if she was able to observe, we wouldn't see her on the attendee list. Is that right?
Oh, I should be able to see her on the attendees list and pull her over, but she's just not in the Zoom at all. So I'm just trying to figure out kind of where the issue's coming up on why she's not able to join. The link and the password and everything we have on the web page is accurate. So, did she say the password's not working for her, or did she specify what error message she's getting?
She just said the link wasn't working, and I did a copy paste from the hearing examiner web page. So let me send her that again and see. Okay. And I could always email something directly to her if I have her email, if that would be helpful.
Yeah, Ms. Clemson, if you could email Ms. Schlater, that would help too. Ms. Schlater, maybe you could put your email address in the chat.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Ms. Clungeon, were you going to put Sarah Cook's email in the chat so I could email her the link, or?
Yes, I could do that.
Okay, great. Maybe that will help a little bit.
Yep.
Okay, great. I'm going to get this over to her right now.
And you sent her the password too, Ms. Schlager.
Yes, absolutely. All right, the link, the meeting ID, and the password has been sent to her. So hopefully that will allow her to join.
Oh, she has. Okay. I think it's a, we can get started now then. So,
oh, here she is.
Okay. Yep, there she is. Okay, Great. Mr. Wright, we don't have your video. Can you put your video on?
I'm not seeing a button on here that allows me to click video.
Is that, and Ms. Slater, he is a panelist at this point, right? Because I know the attendees can't do video usually, but the panelists can.
Yeah, let me look at something here real quick.
Ms. Wright, yeah, you probably noticed the video icon is at the bottom left of your screen. And it usually has, when you can't use it, it has a red bar through it, and you just click on it, and then you can.
He's been promoted to a panelist, so there should be the video option.
Okay, now he should do it. All right. There he is. Okay. All right, Mr. Wright, just raise your right hand when we swear in. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. Welcome to the hearing. And Mr. Wachter, go ahead.
Again, Your Honor, or excuse me, Mr. Examiner, Ms. Oda will be handling the question.
Oh, sorry.
Right. This witness.
Oda, go ahead.
Right. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thanks for asking.
Can you please state your full name and professional address?
Sure. My name is Christopher Wright. My professional address is Radke Associates, 2111 North Northgate Way, Suite 219, Seattle, Washington.
And what is your position at Radke Associates?
I am the president of Radke Associates.
Can you briefly describe your professional background and qualifications in wetland delineation and soil science?
I can. I hold an undergraduate degree in agriculture with an emphasis in soil and water sciences. I have been conducting wetland work for nearly 40 years. I originally worked for the United States Forest Service conducting ecosystem surveys in which we identified wetlands and delineated them. I then came to work in private consulting in the early 1990s and have been in private consulting since then. I've been at Radke Associates now for almost 30 years.
Okay. And then have you previously been qualified as an expert in wetland delineation for legal proceedings?
I have. I am recognized as a subject matter expert in wetlands and wetland regulatory issues in federal, state, and local jurisdictions.
Okay. And then did Kitsap County retain you to conduct a peer review of the applicant's post-remand wetland analysis for this project site?
Yes, they did. We hold a third part, an on-call contract with Kitsap County to conduct third-party reviews of wetland-related materials that are submitted to the county.
Okay. And can you describe the scope of the assignment for this case?
Yes. Again, we were issued a copy of the remand order, very specifically asking for a peer review of the work that was requested from the applicant's consultant on the project site. As such, we went to the site in July of last year, met with representatives of Kitsap County, Mr. Steve Hickok and Mr. Jeff Smith, in which we then proceeded to the site. We had identified in the June of 24 report prepared by Soundview and the applicant's consultants to look at the pits. And again, because the remand was very specific that we address the pits in which the A11 hydric soil indicator was in question, as we understood it from the remand, is that we went to the pits that had been identified as being hydric soil as a result of the A11 indicator. At those locations, we located the stakes with flags on them marking the sample plot identifiers that had been placed by the applicant's consultant at the time. There were no stakes representing where the appellant's consultant had established their plots, because the direction was for the applicant's consultant to do pits in proximity to the appellant's consultant. We presumed that they had done that correctly and were in the location that we needed to. We then found an undisturbed location within the vicinity of the stake for the other sample plots. Again, we did this because digging a hole in a location where a hole had already been excavated does not allow you to look at what the natural state of the soil is. Rather, what you're looking at is the jumble of soil when the hole was backfilled. So we opened new holes in relatively close proximity. The holes were all 5, 6, maybe even 7 feet away from the other holes, but they were not in a significantly different area, and that they were established within a similar vegetation community as to what where the applicant's sample plots had been located. We then recorded all of the data. We described the soil profile at each one of those. We recorded all of the vegetation that was in the immediate vicinity of that sample plot and made note of any indicators of hydrology that we encountered at each one of those. So we did that for 4 sample plots in the vicinity of Wetland A, and then we did it for 2 sample plots in the southwestern portion of the site.
Okay. And so specifically in, obviously I'm not a scientist, but in layman's terms of you, when you dig those test holes and you are supposed to check in the same area as a prior test hole, it's not standard to get the same dirt from that test hole. You have to get an undisturbed, that's industry standard.
That is industry standard. You do not open up a hole that was previously opened because, again, it's been disturbed. You are not looking at the natural state of the soil in that location, nor are you looking at the natural state of vegetation because, again, that's been disturbed, removed from the ground surface in order to then excavate a hole below it. So again, you look at a location that you see a similar vegetation community that is in close enough proximity, similar topographic setting as to the hole that you're trying to gather data to either corroborate what's there, or, you know, identify what you see versus what was reported by the other consultant.
Mm-hmm. And so when did you review the applicant's report of this? Before you visited, after?
We did. We were provided with a copy of the 2024 Soundview report prior to making our visit in July of 2024. I should also note that we had previously been asked to go look at this site under our third-party review in 2021. And Colton Costers, our project manager for this and the lead for doing these third-party reviews in Kitsap County, went and met with Mr. Steve Hickok on that occasion in 2021, at which point it was, we were then made aware that the Department of Ecology had already done a site walk, had reviewed the wetland boundary, and had offered a letter of concurrence with the wetland boundary, at which point we were somewhat confused about what we were supposed to do at that point, given that the agency with authority and responsibility for determining the extent of wetlands had already made a decision that the wetland as mapped was the extent of regulatory wetland on the site.
And so what's your conclusion with respect to the thoroughness of the applicant's report field work?
Again, having reviewed the 2024 report that they did in response to the remand, it appeared to us that they had met the requirements. They had gone and established new sample plots in the vicinity of the appellant's consultant sample plots. They had described the conditions that they had found there and that they had not found conditions that met hydric soil criteria according to their report. Mm-hmm. Again, we opened up our own holes and we made our own descriptions of what was there and then made our own determinations. In the vicinity of Wetland A, three of the four holes that we opened up did not meet the criteria of hydric soil. One did, and it in fact met the A11 criteria. All of the sample plots met the criteria for hydrophytic vegetation. And again, three of the four pits did not meet any hydrology criteria, while the third pit, our sample plot two, did in fact have secondary indicators of hydrology. There was no observable hydrology, but again, we were there in, I think, July 20, after an extremely droughty period, the spring and early summer of 2024. We're well below normal in terms of precip, so we would not have anticipated to have seen any hydrology in those locations. But we did see what's called drainage patterns, places where we previously there had been water flowing on the surface, and other secondary indicators of hydrology, which led us to believe that our sample plot two would in fact meet the criteria to be It met all three parameters necessary to be considered a wetland.
Did you review soil parameters other than A11?
Yes, we took all of our own data and then applied all of the, went through the entire checklist that is included within the field indicators of hydric soils of the United States to determine if the soil that we were seeing met any of the indicators, as well as the definitions of hydric soil that are contained in the 1987 Corps of Engineers wetland delineation manual. Again, the soils other than what we observed in our test pit two did not meet any criteria to be considered a hydric soil.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there a change in predominant species in the test plot areas?
Because it is a pasture setting and that because of seasonal dominance of different vegetation within the plots is that we recorded different species than were recorded by either the applicant or the appellant as occurring in that, which is not an unusual circumstance in pasture delineations at all. Again, in the spring, there are plant species that emerge that grow and then senesce and other species take over as it gets warmer and drier. And then towards the end of the summer, yet another suite of species becomes the visually predominant species that occur within the within a pasture. That's the way that it happens in this area. It's not a situation like you have with woody vegetation where, you know, a tree is there and you can go back and see the same tree or the same shrub year after year after year. These are all species that, you know, grow and die in months, and that different species have different life cycles and begin and end their lives across seasonally across a year.
Okay. Now, were you present for Dr. Cook's testimony in this hearing?
I was.
Did you review Dr. Cook's report?
I reviewed the 2024 report by Dr. Cook. I've never had the opportunity to look at the earlier documentation that she presented.
And so she identified areas that exhibit wetland characteristics. And what is your opinion of that?
Based on the data that Sarah Cook presented, is that she identified areas that meet the three parameters of wetlands. My sample plots found different conditions than what were reported by Dr. Cook.
Mm-hmm. One moment. Do you recall test location D16?
SoundView's DP16?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I believe that correlates to our sample plot two.
Okay. And do you remember the specifics of that test plot area?
I can pull up my data form for that, not right off the top of my head. I do know that is the one sample plot that we found all three parameters.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So we established this within 6 to 8 feet of the SoundView plot DP16. I found a vegetation community there comprised of hydrophytic vegetation species. 100% of the dominant species were facultative, or and therefore meeting the criteria of being a hydrophytic vegetation community. I found a soil that had 10 inches of 10YR31 over a 10YR42 soil with 5% redoxymorphic features within the profile. Again, this is a hydric soil, both because it meets the A11 and because of the chroma of 1 within the near surface portion of that, with redoxymorphic features within the soil within the upper 12 inches.
And so do you believe that area represents a true wetland?
I believe that the location where we sampled meets all three parameters of a wetland at that point. It has hydric soil, it has a hydrophytic vegetation community, and it had indicators of hydrology, as I said, drainage patterns, as well as passing what's called the fact neutral test, which is when you disregard the vegetation that is facultative, as you heard in testimony yesterday. That's vegetation that can be found pretty much equally between wetlands and uplands. And so if you disregard that and look at other species, to determine if the vegetation community is leaning towards drier or wetter plant species. The other plant species there were wetter, and therefore, when disregarding the facultative species, it was wetland plant species, thus showing that in likelihood that there is hydrology at that location during the appropriate time of year. Again, late July, not the appropriate time of year to be making hydrologic determinations.
Mm-hmm. And so what are your overall conclusions based on your field observations and review of the applicant's work and of the project site?
Again, we believe that there is a wetland located at the position of Wetland A. We were not tasked with doing a delineation of that wetland. And again, I have to reiterate that the state agency that has the authority and responsibility to determine the extent of jurisdictional wetlands had made a decision that the wetland that was mapped on the site by the applicant's consultants was in fact the extent and limit of jurisdictional wetland on the site. It's not my place to go and tell an agency that they're wrong.
And I think this will be my last question. Do you have any concerns with applicants not using best practices for wetland delineation and any of their work for the site? Obviously, Department of Ecology is the authority.
The authority.
Yes.
And
concerns, yeah. Really?
Again, they delineated a wetland that was accepted by the authority. having jurisdiction in that area. How they reach those conclusions, it's not my position to judge whether or not they did it the way that I would or the way that the manual specifically says, with every I dotted and every T crossed. The point is that they mapped a wetland that was accepted by the agency that has the authority and responsibility to make those decisions.
Okay, I think that's it for me. I believe the other councils will have questions for you.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Examiner, did you think that, should I go ahead? Sorry, you're muted, but I think you nodded your head.
Sorry about that. Yeah, so I was wondering, yeah, I was asking you, Mr. Schutz, if you had any questions.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Wright. My name is Ruben Schutz. I'm one of the attorneys who is representing the applicant in this case. I don't have a lot of questions, so I'll try to keep them brief. I think from looking at your report that you agreed with the findings of Phil Scholes and Rachel Highland as to 8 of the 9 locations that you were tasked with looking at. Is that accurate?
I actually looked at 6 locations.
Sorry, so 5 of the 6 I have about those numbers. Is that accurate?
That is correct.
Okay.
I should say that what I found is that I found that there was no wetland areas that met wetland characteristics at 5 of the 6. It's not necessarily saying I agreed with their work. I'm saying that my observations in the vicinity of their work showed that these areas were not wetlands.
Okay. So your work was consistent with theirs to the extent that both agreed that there was no wetland at to those 5 of the 6 locations.
That's an accurate characterization.
On DB16 or your data plot 2, I believe, it's not uncommon for there to be professional disagreements where an indicator is close, is there? I mean, even between experienced professionals?
No, not at all odd for professionals with years of experience to not see things exactly the same way.
Even applying the same manuals and same indicators, et cetera.
That's correct.
Okay.
Time of day in which observations were made, season in which observations were made, all can influence the what's made by, again, visual observation in the field.
Okay. It's not also not uncommon that when that happens, like say with an agency, that there's that a compromise can be reached. Is that something that occurs?
Yeah, I suppose that there's compromise that's reached, but again, the agencies have the ultimate authority and responsibility to make the decision. And that, you know, if they do not accept the argument that the consultant is making, that look, this is this way because, and that they're saying, nope, we don't see it that way, we see it this way, and therefore, you know, they have the ultimate authority. Again, there are times that you can try to go up the chain within that agency to get things, you know, overruled. It very, very rarely works that way because the subject matter experts from the agencies that are actually making the observations are the ones that are relied upon to be the people that have the authority and responsibility to make that decision. And therefore they make that decision.
Stan. Are you aware that the applicant has proposed an alternative wetland after reviewing your report?
During testimony, I saw a graphic depicting a alternate wetland.
Okay, I'm going to share my screen real quick or try to. I guess looking at a picture at the moment.
I am.
Jump from that one, actually. Is this what you were looking at or heard?
Yeah, that's exactly the drawing I recall seeing from testimony earlier this week.
Okay. And does this alternative wetland then incorporate your data plot too?
It is certainly in the vicinity. The north westernmost portion of what's depicted as a wetland is in the vicinity of where my sample plot 2 was located.
So would this be sort of an example where, you know, if there's professional differences, you know, a compromise can be reached that to sort of to bridge the gap of potential data that doesn't quite match up?
It certainly would be a mechanism to get to a moving forward with the project in terms of saying, all right, we're going to say that this area is a wetland, and so we're not going to affect this area. We're going to set it aside and move on rather than go through the whole process of having, you know, multiple site visits, multiple arguing consultants, and sitting through hours and hours of hearings afterwards.
You say that's especially the case in something like in a circumstance like this, where the Department of Ecology has already determined that the wetland is 355 feet, and this would make the wetland, I think I heard, 571 feet.
Yeah, I mean, again, if the applicant is willing to set this area aside just to offer assurances to others that no wetland area is being disturbed, that it would be a reasonable approach to moving forward with a project.
Okay. And you, I assume you haven't, you know, looked at that, you weren't tasked with this or looked at this data, but are you aware that Phil Scholes and Rachel Highland went back out and did additional plots to try to, you know, determine that, to make sure that that alternative wetland, you know, was not, there wasn't something, you know, bigger out to the sides or something like that?
I did hear testimony earlier this week that they had gone and collected additional data in that vicinity.
Okay. And I think the testimony was that they collected 8 more data plots. I don't think they're all shown here. This is just an image of the area. Would you say that's eight more would be pretty comprehensive?
Very comprehensive for an area this small.
Okay. And you talked about relative vicinity, you know, being 5, 6, 7 feet away and not digging, directly next to because it's disturbed. Was that accurate testimony?
Yes, that was accurate testimony.
Okay.
And again, you know, looking at this photograph that's up here right now, the sample plot stake that's labeled DP16 in the middle of that area, if you'll notice that there's quite a swath of area around that that includes DP23, DP24, DP28, that all has the same visual vegetation community that's present there, as well as topographically is, again, very similar. It's appears to me that this photo looks to me like it's taken from the from west facing east there. And so you can see that the ground slopes slightly to the south, to the right-hand side of the photograph. And again, my sample plot 2 was done to the south, a slightly lower elevation than the actual DP16 location. And again, I did find indicators of wetland there, but it certainly would not have been an attempt to go to higher ground or someplace that was significantly different than the sample plot that I understood I was supposed to be evaluating in order to obfuscate that data.
And with regard to not digging directly next to, you know, because it might be disturbed, if the disturbance happened even a couple of years ago, would that still apply?
Absolutely. You want to look at soil in its native state, soil that has developed over decades and perhaps even millennia.
Okay. And you know, being in the general vicinity, I know that wetlands can, you know, start and stop, but you kind of take it all into consideration. You look around and get the context. And then if you're within the general vicinity, you're getting a good idea of whether there's wetland there.
That's correct.
Okay. I think that's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Clunchan.
All right, good morning, Mr. Wright.
Good morning.
Okay, I have a couple of questions, but we'll keep it brief. You discussed before that it's, best practice, you don't sample in the same place. When you're going out and doing a delineation or doing soil samples, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And, but could you do a hole within 3 feet of a previous pit? Would that be good practice?
You need to do the pit within an area that does not have evidence of past disturbance. And again, when you open a hole, mm-hmm. you know, you're not hovering in the air above that ground. You're standing there. You usually have at least one, usually two. And in my case, I had four people standing there. So you've got a hole that's probably 18 inches in diameter that you're opening up. Then you have people standing around it, which is taking up at least another 2 feet on either side of that. So you're talking about an area of disturbance that's probably 6 feet in diameter in order to open up one hole. So again, if there was a hole that was opened up by somebody else, that hole, again, 18 inches in diameter, the area around it that's being disturbed. So you don't want to dig in an area that was previously disturbed. You want to get outside of the zone of disturbance. Hence the reason that for the most part, my holes were 5 to 8 feet away from the location of the sample plot stakes that I found.
Okay. And those the sample plot stakes there, you assumed that those were similar locations to Dr. Cook's sample plots, correct?
Again, it was my understanding that the remand directed the applicant's consultant to go do sample plots in close proximity to Dr. Cook's plots. Again, Dr. Cook's plots were not marked in the field. The SoundView plots were.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you do any comparisons for vegetation between SoundView's sample plots and Dr. Cook's sample plots? Was that at all part of your analysis?
I did not. Again, as I testified earlier, is that successional vegetation communities within pastures, different times of year, are different vegetation species that are readily apparent in that area. The other sample plots were done at different times of year from when I was there. Therefore, I recorded the vegetation community that was present in the plot area during my field investigation. Again, I must note that every one of my sample plots that I did on the site contained a hydrophytic plant community that is predominantly facultative or wetter plants. In most cases, just predominantly facultative plants, that is plant species that occur fairly equally within wetlands and within uplands.
Okay. But so you recorded what you found, the vegetation when you went out. You didn't necessarily do any sort of comparisons. That wasn't part of, you didn't focus on that in your review.
Again, comparing vegetation in a pasture setting that are collected in different seasons, in different years, is not an accurate comparison. You know, it's comparing, you know, again, I went to the ball game last night, and what was the score of the ball game last night? Is that the same as what the score of the ball game was 2 weeks ago? No, it's a different situation.
Would you agree that there is some vegetation that is relatively consistent throughout the year? You would be able to identify it in March versus September if it were present?
Well, certainly all woody vegetation is consistent across the year. It doesn't grow, die, and then start to decompose across a year. But within herbaceous plant communities is that those communities change in species composition, at least visually dominant species composition, from the early part of the growing season to the middle of the summer to the fall period and across the winter. There are different species that grow cyclically within pasture type settings.
So for canary grass, would you be able to identify canary grass in July?
Of course, you would be able to recognize canary grass whenever you see it. However, none of the plots that I excavated had canary grass in them, nor did I observe much in the way of canary grass on the site anywhere. There are some patches of it, but it's not a predominant species across the site.
Mm-hmm. Regarding the you, so you visited the site in July, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Would you agree that July is not an, is not an appropriate time of year to look at hydrology for a site?
I testified to that earlier. Yes, July is not the appropriate time of year to make a hydrologic determination in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay. Would you agree that this, so I want to get to this, the soils and colors, and would you agree that soils with a chroma of one or two with redoxymorphic features are classified as a wetland, or are classified as hydric soils?
Yes.
Okay. So I want to pull up, and you previously testified that when you went out, the only plot that you identified was a wetland was the DP16, or I believe it was your plot two.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. So if this is exhibit F18, 22, page 22. I just want to pull this up. All right. Are you able to see my screen?
I am.
Okay. So F18, PDF page 22, this is DP28. So different from the plots that we were just talking about, where here we've got on this second line here between 8 and 12.5 inches, this number two, where it goes three and then two, and then has faint redoxymorphic features over in the remarks. So if given that and the presence of wetland vegetation and wetland hydrology, wouldn't you agree that that data point should have also been classified as a wetland and has the three parameters?
Again, that's not my data. The data that I collected was different than what was reported in this data point.
Okay.
The reason that I went and opened up my own holes was that I'm not going to rely on observations made by others. You know, people write things down, they see things differently, all of that. So all of my documentation was and determinations were based on my own observations, not an analysis of observations made by others.
Wasn't that your role, though, as a third-party reviewer to review the analysis done by others?
My role of that was to determine, based on my understanding of the remand, was to determine if there was hydric soil present at the locations where there was a disagreement between hydric soil being present between the applicant and the appellant. So I have one that says yes, one that says no. The only way I can make a decision is to collect my own data at that point. I can't choose and say, oh, I believe this person and I don't believe that person. So I collected my own data in which then drew my own conclusions from.
Okay. If you were reviewing someone else's data and you looked at this sheet for DP28, would you agree that the three parameters for wetland hydrology are present?
Again, I don't know what they said about hydrology in that plot, but it's the box is marked yes, but didn't scroll down to that. But yes, that's a hydrophytic vegetation community. I would have questions about whether or not that was a hydric soil. Again, the fact that, as was testified to yesterday, that they're saying that it's less than 1% redoxymorphic features there does pose a question. Again, the regulatory, field indicators of hydric soil indicate that 2% of redoxymorphic features is probably the limit to which can be detected by the human eye. And therefore, statements that it's less than 1% is either it's not there or that it had a greater percentage. So there would certainly be questions. And what I would do in that case, were I reviewing this, is that I would go and excavate my own hole there and make my own observations.
Okay,
as I did in this process, where I did not find indicators of hydric soil in five of the six plots that I opened up.
Right, but so you just explained, though, where you were doing your plots was 6 feet away from, 6 to 8 feet away from the from these plots, correct?
Yes.
Wouldn't you agree that 6 to 8 feet is kind of, it can be a significant difference for the presence of wetland?
Again, I selected my sites to go to an undisturbed site in an area of similar vegetation. And when I had a topographic choice, I went downhill to an area that would be more likely to contain wetland hydrology indicators. Again, hydric soils are derived from their soils interaction with water. So my locations of my holes were not designed to go find an upland, but were indeed determined and placed in a location that if there was hydric soil present and wetland hydrology, I would be more likely to find it because I was lower topographically than the location of the sample plot that I was evaluating.
Okay, but just to confirm, it's not the same location.
You don't dig in the same location because you're not looking at a native soil. You're looking at a disturbed soil. You're looking at a disturbed vegetation community.
Mm-hmm. But for this plot, right? So you can't dig in the same, you can't dig in the same spot necessarily, but if you were reviewing this information with all of, with this information and the hydrology parameters present, would you agree that this would indicate that there is a wetland at DP28 without?
I would certainly question the data that is resulting from that, because in the zone of 8 to 12.5 inches, they're indicating that they're seeing redox, but that it's less than 1%, which again, testimony before, is difficult to determine. Again, when they're finding redoxymorphic features below that in greater concentrations, 5%, that does not meet the criteria of a hydric soil because the redoxymorphic features are too deep within the soil profile to indicate that the hydrology is within the majority of the rooting zone. Therefore, I would open up another hole. I would have questions about this sample plot's accuracy.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with research that says people can, in order to detect redoxymorphic features, it has to be around 5% in order for the eye to detect it?
I'm not familiar with that research. I am familiar with the fact that the hydric soil indicator indicates that 2% is the number that can be observed, and that some of the criteria are it needs to have a minimum of 2% redoxymorphic features. If people were unable to detect 2%, I don't see why there would be a criteria that it would be 2% redoxymorphic features within the soil profile.
So you're assuming because the manual criteria is 2% then that must mean that people can see 2%?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay. And when was that manual published?
It's been updated several times. I believe its original publication date was 2006.
Okay. And is it possible that there's been literature since then that has indicated that people can't see it, but can't detect them until it's around 5%?
Again, for the purposes of my work, I rely on the guidance that's provided to me by the agencies and authorities having the responsibility to make the decisions about hydric soils and wetland determinations. The opinions of individuals about what they believe is, that's great. That's their opinion. However, I rely on the guidance of the regulation and the regulatory framework in which I must operate.
Okay. Are you aware that 2% figure was updated to 5% in 2015, actually, because people couldn't detect it?
5%? I am not aware of that change.
Okay. All right, and then similar, I want to look at, this is F18, PDF page 16. Similarly, Here we have, these are sound view plots, but there is wetland vegetation and then hydrology. Down to the hydrology. There's the two indicators there for their two secondary indicators for wetland hydrology. And then here within 7 to 12 inches, we have that chroma of 2 and again, rhodoxomorphic features. So based on this information, without doing your own plots, if you were reviewing that, wouldn't you conclude that the three parameters were present for DP25?
Again, much like the last plot, is that they're recording less than 1% there. And so I would question whether or not that actually existed because of the inability to determine if less than 1% of redoxymorphic features. Once you get to the 7% or 11, if they're adding, I'm not sure there, it's a strange way of putting that in the plot. But again, that the concentration of redoxymorphic features within that profile are too deep to meet the criteria of being a hydric soil.
Wouldn't you agree, though, that the depth that you can look for that can be different if the site has been plowed or has a history of soil disturbance?
It certainly would be. You would certainly look at that. However, we did do a review of aerial photographs of the site, and we can find no evidence that the site was plowed on aerial photographs going back to 1950. So that would indicate that for 75 years, the site has not been plowed. Any disturbance and resulting from plowing that occurred more than 75 years ago would essentially be eliminated at this point if the soil were buried, as we heard testimony before, creating a situation where that's deeper than the lack of redoxymorphic features within the upper portion of the rooting zone, which is required to meet the wetland hydrology criteria, would not be met because the influence on the soil is too deep for it to be. And again, after 75 years, that circumstance would be considered normal circumstance on the site. It would no longer be considered a plowed or problematic site. If the plowing had occurred 75 days ago, certainly is an issue. But if it was 75 years ago, that plowing is no longer influential on whether or not the site meets wetland hydrology criteria or hydric soil criteria.
For the disturbed or plowed site, does the manual specify a length of time?
No, but the agencies generally require anything that has not been disturbed for more than 5 years to now be in its normal circumstance.
Okay, but that's not reflected in the manual.
No, that's reflected in guidance from the Army Corps of Engineers.
Okay. You stated that, you know, the Department of Ecology, their role before where they agreed with a previous wetland and that it wasn't your role to question the department. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Okay. Are you aware that there was a significant disagreement between the actual wetland scientist and the department regarding the delineation of that wetland?
I've heard rumors. I wasn't involved in this situation at the time. I have no knowledge of what happened during the field investigation. What I do have knowledge of is that the agency, having the authority and responsibility to make the determination, sent a message to the county saying that the wetland boundary is confirmed.
Okay. Are you aware that the wetland scientist from the Department of Ecology, when she went out to the site, she delineated a wetland a little over 5,000 square feet on the site?
I do not know that. All I know, again. Okay.
Uh, And are you aware that the letter agreeing to the smaller delineation was issued by the lead of ecology who has no background or training as a wetland scientist?
I am aware who issued the letter. However, again, it doesn't change the fact that the agency having the authority and responsibility to make those determinations made that determination. Whether or not the appellant disagrees with it has no bearing. Unless
it's not the appellant. It was the wetland scientist who did the delineation for the Department of Ecology. The Department of Ecology scientist is the one who disagreed.
Again, the agency's official position is that the wetland as mapped is the extent of jurisdictional wetland on the property. I wasn't there. I have no other knowledge to go on other than the fact that the regulatory agency that makes these decisions made a decision on this site. I'm aware that there are people that disagree with it. Some may have worked for the Department of Ecology. Some may be private consultants. The point is that the decision has been made. And until such time as someone overturns that decision, and that was not the purpose of this remand. The purpose of this remand was to determine whether or not hydric soils were located at specific portions of this site. I went out, excavated holes, found that in five of the six holes that I opened up did not contain hydric soil.
Okay. You say ecology made this determination, but they have not, to your knowledge, have they done any sort of delineation on the site since the remand?
Not that I'm aware of. In fact, okay. I believe within that same letter confirming it, they have made the statement that their involvement with this site is complete.
Mm-hmm. So the Department of Ecology has not been involved at all. Okay, that's fine. Getting back to the reed canary grass where you said that you would be able to identify it, are you aware that Dr. Cook identified the area that she identified as a wetland in the meadow is dominated by reed canary grass?
I'm aware that she testified that there was an area that the wetland is dominated by reed canary grass.
Mm-hmm.
My observations were very little reed canary grass on the site. So we saw different things at different times in different years.
Okay. Would that also indicate that was perhaps a different location?
Again, my locations were based on the stakes that were placed by SoundView, who were directed to do in the proximity to the sample plots prepared by Dr. Cook. While it was different location, not exactly right on top of Dr. Cook's plots. My sample plots were in a similar topographic setting, in a similar vegetation community, within, again, no more than 6 or 7 feet away from the sample plot location. It is unlikely that a vegetation community dominated by a persistent plant would have disappeared, although there was a 3 or 4 year time difference between there. I do not know if in the intervening period somebody came through and mowed the site. I don't know if somebody came through and applied herbicide to the site and removed vegetation that was there. Again, the reason you do not compare vegetation data in pasture settings across time and season is that the vegetation community changes. The composition of the vegetation community can change.
One more minute. I think those are all of my questions. Thank you, Mr. Wright.
Okay, got a few before we get to redirect. Mr. Wright, I'm finding your comments about DOE jurisdiction really interesting. You're saying DOE sets the classification and delineation, not Kitsap County in this case? That's what you've been saying. So I'm really kind of baffled by your comments.
So again, the regulations regarding wetlands are prepared by the local jurisdiction, Kitsap County in this case. However, they are reviewed and approved by the Department of Ecology. In this particular case, it is my understanding that the county asked for the Department of Ecology to come to the site, or at some point they asked for regulatory review from agencies above them in order to help them to make a determination of where that is, where the wetland boundary on this particular site was. This is not uncommon. Many jurisdictions will do that do not have in-house technical expertise to do that. They go to the subject matter expert, which is the Department of Ecology, to make those decisions.
They use it for guidance, but isn't it still this county that makes the final decision as to what the delineation is, what the classification is?
That certainly what the classification is, but in terms of where the wetland edge is that authority to make jurisdictional determinations lies with the Department of Ecology and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Okay. So did that influence your decision-making and independent assessment of this wetland and your understanding of DOE's jurisdiction?
No, I went out and excavated my own holes. And again, I wasn't tasked with doing a delineation of where the wetland was. I was tasked with doing a determination of if hydric soil was located in very specific portions of the site, which I did, and collected the other data to help inform that in the event that that soil profile was somewhat confused. And as such, no, what's influenced me is trying to understand why it is that this we're continuing on this when the decision on there is a wetland there and where the wetland is has been made by the Department of Ecology. So again, maybe you can help me, Mr. Examiner, to understand why it is that we're questioning that.
Because it's in the county code that we make that decision. But just final question, setting aside DOE's guidance given to the county, how confident are you in the delineation given all your knowledge of all the test pits that were taken, that kind of thing? I mean, do we have an accurate delineation in this case?
I didn't review the delineation, Mr. Examiner. I observed very specific locations to determine whether or not there was hydric soil located in those locations. Based on what I found, I would be very comfortable with the delineation that was presented.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Mr. Wright. All right. Let's jump back to Ms. Oda for redirect.
I don't have any redirect, Mr. Examiner. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Wright, for coming over. Really appreciate your help on this tough case. Thanks a lot. All right, so let's see. And I know Mr. Adams is, Ms. Clungeon, did you have any other witnesses other than Mr. Adams? I don't recall. I know we're still in your part of the hearing. And Ms. Clungeon, you're muted, by the way, if you're going to say something.
Yes, thank you. Given the condition for the 6 PPD. We don't have any other witnesses.
Okay. Are you agreeing to the condition then? Is that right?
I would agree to the condition that Mr. Lin proposed. I mean, it's not necessarily as robust as we would have liked. He basically just agreed to a condition that they would follow the code when it was adopted, which is what they have to do anyway. But what we were hoping here was a condition that where if mitigation is identified by the department or measures that can be put in place to basically mitigate any of the 6 PPD from the stormwater runoff from the site between now and when the site is developed, that would be implemented.
Okay, good. Well, glad that was resolved anyway. So no other witnesses then is what you're saying.
Correct.
So I guess we just have Mr. Adams coming in and then, Mr. Wachter, you had a couple other county witnesses you said. I guess we can jump to you at this point. Oh, sorry, Ms. Clinton, was there something?
Oh, yeah. So if we may want to call Dr. Cook back for rebuttal on some of Mr. Wright's testimony.
Yeah, that's fine. All right, Mr. Wachter, I know you had Mr. Heacock you thought you might call up and another witness as well.
Yes, thank you. excuse me. At this point, I believe the county is going to proceed with calling Jeff Smith.
Okay.
I believe we will probably not be calling Mr. Heacock based on the testimony based on the state of the testimony at this point. So again, my colleague Ms. Oda is prepared to do a direct exam on Mr. Smith, and that's how we intend to proceed. If you want a county witness,
sure. Yeah, let's bring him up.
No, I'll pull him over right now.
Perfect. All right, here you are, Mr. Smith. Just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth, this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. All right, go ahead, Ms. Soda.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. Hello, good morning, Mr. Smith. How are you?
Good morning, fine.
Can you please state your name and position for the record?
My name is Jeff Smith. I'm a senior planner with Kitsap County Department of Community Development.
And how long have you held that position?
Oh, 30 years.
And what are your responsibilities with respect to land use and development applications?
I review commercial development, apartments, retail development, subdivisions, development agreements, etc.
Mm-hmm. And are you familiar with the applicant's proposal on this matter?
Yes, I am.
And what are you specifically responsible for in this project?
Responsible for reviewing this project against the Kitsap County Code and also against the Silverdale Design Standards. Project lead and coordinate review between the other reviewers, the county, third party review, and any other outside agencies.
Mm-hmm. And are you familiar with the hearing examiner's remand ruling for this?
Yes, I am.
What other DCD personnel were involved in this remand review and for what purposes?
It was, at this point, it was mainly Steve Heacock and myself on this particular remand issue.
Okay. And have you reviewed the applicant's feasibility analysis submitted for this remand hearing?
Yes. Yes, I have.
And is it fair to say that the county did not necessarily focus on feasibility issue in the previous hearing before the remand?
Not to the same degree. The when I received this project, it was reassigned because the previous planner took another position. The applicant worked with that planner to address the feasibility at that time, not specifically, but that's when the applicant proposed relaxation of the parking spaces and then proposing to work with Kitsap Transit to buy 75 transit passes for a period of 10 years. So they could reduce the need for off-street parking, so they didn't need to have structured parking on the site.
And so are those the key elements of the feasibility analysis for this remand?
The remand though is more specific. It addressed the site conditions, the potential groundwater impacts or artesian well impacts. It looked at the market far as the feasibility based on achieving rents that might be commanded. Just overall construction practices, and they even addressed far as the ability to address potential impacts to the surrounding property owners, because that was something that was brought up in previous testimony by the appellants, Mr. Adams, about being respectful to the urban restricted zone where there's single family units up against the boundary, and they're trying to address that at the same time. And the restaurant to the north, they were concerned about the impacts to view as well. And based on having structured parking, having going down or building another floor and going up, that was going to impact their view too. So it's a very tough spot to go beyond what's being proposed, as my observation.
And in the county's view, does the analysis satisfy applicable code requirements?
Well, as staff identified, there's no actual definition of what feasibility means. Mm-hmm. But doing research, casual research, it based on staff's review of what the applicant submitted, it does meet the intention as far as what is feasible, looking at the whole range of issues that were presented.
Mm-hmm. And then do you think that the applicant's feasibility analysis adequately responds to the issues raised in this remand hearing?
Based on the lack of definition, and I believe the applicant or staff believes the applicant has addressed those parameters.
And then is there anything that's unaddressed from the remand hearing of what hearings in Hawaii?
Well, yeah, the staff believes that based on what was resubmitted, there'll have to be additional review for how the project will be interfaced with the site design requirements, with the open area, fires, there's the pedestrian plaza, front door of the buildings, how that's going to all fit together with the off-street parking or surface parking area, if that is the decision by the hearing examiner.
Got it. Okay. One moment, please. Is there anything additional needed to address and evaluate the feasibility or just what you mentioned before, if this is sufficient and this remand is resolved, then just clarification on some design stuff of if this is going forward as it is proposed for this remand?
Yes, based on the lack of definition and research, the staff believes that the applicant has addressed the feasibility analysis and the project should go forward as with the surface parking and no structured parking being.
Okay, I don't have any further questions for you.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Oda. Mr. Schutz, are you the one to call on this one, or would that be Mr. Lin?
I'll go, thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Smith. I just have a couple of quick questions. Have you ever, during your time at the county, have you ever seen a more thorough analysis of feasibility?
No, I have not.
As to this, or you know, any other element of the Silverdale design standards where feasibility is at issue?
Not to this degree, no.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Ms. Clungeon?
Yes. Morning, Mr. Smith. So I just want to make sure that I understand before when you were talking about the previous efforts to reduce the number of parking spaces, and you said that they worked with the transit and reduced the number, and that because they did that they wouldn't have to put parking under the building. Do you recall that?
Yeah, that's what was in the record, and that's as far as what was decided, yeah.
Okay. So was the understanding that if they've reduced the number of spots, they wouldn't have needed to place parking under the building. That was the county's position?
No, that was their position.
Okay. All right. Wouldn't fewer spots as well as parking under the building achieve the intent of kind of reducing the visual impact of parking in the waterfront district?
Well, based on what's being proposed is they're providing screening around the perimeter of the project. Mm-hmm. This a lot of the parking, off-street parking is between the units as well as on the north side of the structures, which interfaces with the more of the RC type commercial zoning to the north.
So there's screening around the site, but the design standards, the idea would be to reduce the impact for the people who are living on the site as well, correct?
Well, as far as quality of life and reducing visual impacts within that is a standard requirement of the zoning code right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in this particular case, the zoning code is more specific than the design standards.
Okay. But wouldn't putting parking under the structure reduce the visual impact for the, at this point, 160 or so residents that are residing on the site?
Well, you could, as far as if you want to reduce visual impacts, that would be a possibility, but the applicant has to look at the viability of that.
Right. Okay. But also, isn't that reducing those visual impacts and reducing that parking, that is an articulated intent in the design code that for this district, correct?
Yeah. But the staff looks at this stuff on every project, as far as commercial projects, as far as like if you have double rows, you have landscaping strips, you have there's 15% of the site has to be in landscaping. And there's also parking lot landscaping. It's based on a ratio of how many parking spaces there are. And the project is consistent with that.
That's okay. Parking spaces and landscaping. But we're talking about the design standard intent to kind of tuck away parking to reduce the visual impact. And because of that, in this waterfront district, they instruct that parking will be under the buildings where feasible. Right?
We're feasible.
We're feasible. Okay. And so your testimony was that, you know, there's no definition of what feasibility means, I believe.
By county code. But right. There are industry standards, yes.
Okay. But then is it your position that that lack of definition mean that standard doesn't really apply?
No.
Okay. So would you agree that feasibility would be basically capable of being constructed on the site?
Well, based on their feasibility analysis, and I believe this would be very problematic to put structured parking in.
Okay. And would you agree that the main reason that they've identified is basically that it would cost more?
No, it's more than that.
Okay.
Identified issues that are site specific that would be a limiting factor as far as how structured parking would function.
Okay. All right. And are you aware that are you aware that the design standards call for building up instead of out?
Yeah, that's part of the Silverdale Center, which has Silverdale as the center's designation through the PSRC.
Right.
Yes.
And one of the main, so apart from cost, one of their, primary arguments is that they would have to go deeper or that it would somehow impact the aquifer. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Of the constraint? Okay. But wouldn't you agree that doesn't take into account that it could go up instead of down?
Well, again, the big issue previously that was brought up by Mr. Adams was about being respectful to the single family residential zone. We spent three mm-hmm. or four days talking about that. If by raising it, that mm-hmm. would change respectability, let's say, of the development adjacent to the urban restricted zone to the south.
Okay.
And so I'd say that would be a factor as far as it going up higher.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But so you mentioned that you kind of inherited this project from a different planner, right? And when was it that you became the reviewer for this project?
2020.
Okay. But you're aware of, were you aware of previous, in like 2017, the original project application as well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right.
I remember when it was another project in 2006, 2008.
All right. Okay. Did that project have parking under the building?
It did, but there was water issues that the staff identified, and as the applicant did further research and looking at the potential aquifer conditions, they mm-hmm. chose to not do that.
Okay. Would you agree that since 2017, the overall kind of design or layout of this project has not really changed?
The overall placement maybe of the buildings, the footprints have not changed. But
the footprints, the orientation.
The orientation hasn't changed, but based on what the hearing examiner is conditioned, how the project is stepped back from the urban restricted zone, that has changed.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't expect it to change on the north side because you have the Social Security building, you've got a chiropractic type laser surgery building. I don't think that would need to change.
Okay. But when we're talking about the step down and being respectful of those adjacent uses, is one of the ways you could do that to kind of place additional distance or setback or buffering from those uses?
Well, the applicant is proposing a buffer along that
right.
southern edge. There could be a greater setbacks, but right now, based on the parking, is mainly between the buildings and it's not up against the property line. So that should reduce potential impacts as far as noise, light, and noise. Noise, light.
So you're saying that the parking being between the buildings somehow reduces the impact of the parking?
Yes, it does. It reduces the impacts to the urban restricted zone.
Okay. Are you aware of other projects in the vicinity that are multi-unit apartment buildings that do have parking under the building?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Were you involved?
Yes, I was.
Were you involved in any of those projects?
Yes.
Okay, which ones?
Well, there's a project being discussed about the North Beach development.
Okay.
Which is a very limited site. The mainly the footprint is covers a majority of the site. There's very little surface parking there. There's they achieve density and go up. They have to use structured parking.
Mm-hmm. And that's a waterfront site, right?
Yes, and they have to get a variance.
It's also adjacent to kind of the Clear Creek area, correct?
Yeah, it's about 1,300 feet to the east.
Okay. All right. So do you know if there were any kind of groundwater issues with that?
Not specifically. It was backfilled a long time ago. It used to be a cement processing plant site.
Okay.
So, but there has not been any groundwater to speak of identified so far.
Mm-hmm. What about the rivulet apartments that were constructed in 2023? Are you familiar with those?
Are we talking off of Blaine Avenue?
Yes.
Yeah. I was involved with that one too.
Okay. And that's a multi-unit apartment building, correct?
Right.
Okay. And
that is a mixture of surface parking and structured parking.
Okay. So we have these other examples. So would you agree that it is feasible to construct a multi-unit apartment building in this area of Silverdale that has parking under the building?
It depends on the subsurface geology and as far as the water table too.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't that rivulet apartment, wasn't that also kind of near a water source?
Well, it's near Clear Creek, but mm-hmm. it has different subsurface geology conditions.
Mm-hmm.
This particular project is down gradient from Silverdale, where there's a lot of groundwater movement that the declivity is down to the shoreline. So, and I think that whole neighborhood down below this project experiences water flows.
Okay. So wouldn't the units that are subgrade kind of experience those similar issues with groundwater flow?
Not in those particular locations, as far as I know.
Okay.
That wasn't identified as a potential issue.
The groundwater was not identified as a
particular based on those apartments issue. Near Clear Creek. They weren't identified.
Oh, we're talking Clear Creek. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, we kind of touched on this, but, you know, you say there's this lack of definition for feasibility. So I just want to get an understanding of what you believe, when you're reviewing, how do you determine, if somebody gives you a feasibility study, what criteria are you using or how are you analyzing that to determine whether that's accurate?
In previous situations, developers looked at economic impacts. However, this feasibility analysis was covered a range of issues besides the far as the expense, but the developer went into greater detail as far as looking at the cost per unit, cost per parking stall, looking what the market could bear. It was more comprehensive in that regard for looking at the economic impacts as well as the existing site conditions.
Okay. When you're looking at the feasibility, are you at all considering whether there are alternative designs that could be feasible on the site?
My job is not to question what the developer has proposed. They have the responsible for carrying that forward. There might be, when staff reviews these projects, they look at potential impacts and maybe how that could be mitigated. There might be fire and life safety issues, or there might be access issues that may re-change orientation of the project. But it's the developer's proposal. And
okay, so you don't consider it your role to review it and suggest to the developer that a different design could be feasible on the site?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
The only way to look at potential impacts, there might be some cases where staff would make a recommendation for that,
mm-hmm.
Based on Kitsap County code, but based on density, access, and how the developer wants to proceed forward, that's they need to defend that.
Okay. There have been some statements about kind of whether they could obtain the rents needed to cover some of the costs involved with construction, right? Mm-hmm. Whether the market could bear it, mm-hmm. essentially. Would the presence of the North Beach apartment buildings and the Rivulet apartment buildings with the structured parking indicate that there is a market for multi-unit buildings with structured parking underneath and presumably elevators and things like that? There's a sufficient number of people willing to pay those prices for those amenities and those locations?
Yeah, based on their market analysis, that's what they determined that's feasible for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
However, this particular design district specifically calls out feasibility of as far as the 9.5 of the design district, as far as is parking feasible, structured parking feasible, and it was determined no.
Okay, well, my question is more, wouldn't the presence of projects like North Beach and projects like Rivulet demonstrate that it is feasible to construct multi-unit apartment residences with parking under the building in this area of Silverdale?
Based on staff's observations, the subsurface geology is a determinant as far as how big they can excavate down to because of groundwater conditions.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how far either the North Beach or the Rivulet apartments needed to dig down and excavate for those structures?
Well, based on the analysis the applicant provided, it's fairly consistent as far as the net result would be if they dug down to create another floor.
I'm not talking about what the applicant submitted here.
Yeah,
I'm saying specific to North Beach and Rivulet, do you know how far they needed to excavate in order to put parking under the building?
Not specifically. It's a okay. building code issue.
Okay. So you don't know if it was more or less than this site?
Maybe there are they'll have to dig some more because the way the geography is different because those are sites were flatter mm-hmm. they would have to excavate more.
Do you recall what the grade is of this site
or this site?
The slope
Yeah, it's around 5 to 6%.
Okay. Would you agree that over a, you know, 5.3 acre site, that's a relatively gentle grade?
It's a gentle grade, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Ms. Clungeon, do you want to take your break now, or do you,
yes.
or are you almost done? Okay,
yeah, let's actually, take our break. I might only have a few more, but thank you.
Okay, let's go till 10:50 then. We'll see you at 10:50.
Great. Thank you.